So the topic tonight is this series of talks that I started maybe three talks ago all have to do with wisdom and then the arising of wisdom from different kinds of experiences. And if you've taken a look at the book that we're working with, Bhikkhu Bodhi, the one that he edited in the Buddha's words, you know, I think it's a good explanation of what wisdom is, and it's an interesting thing because our minds are used to believing that our concepts can adequately define and describe things. And one of the things that you find out when you begin to have deeper experiences from these particular kinds of Buddhist practices is that your language and concepts fail you. That the experience that you're having is bigger, is more multidimensional than you can convey in language. And wisdom is one of those things. And it's part of the reason that when you look at the Buddha's description of wisdom, he uses a lot of imagery and analogies as opposed to hard conceptual definitions. So one of the descriptions that the Buddha commonly gave was that wisdom was a form of illumination, of light, that there was the darkness of confusion or ignorance. Ignorance meaning the failure or inability to understand how and why we suffer. And that this piercing form of insight results in wisdom that illuminates the direct and proximate causes of our suffering and how suffering rolls out, you know, the sequencing of suffering and why suffering happens. Another image that he used was that wisdom was a knife that would cut through confusion and lay it bare and open so that you could see it clearly. And that's what this tanka over on your right of Manjushri. And this is an unusual tanka because I've never seen another tanka that depicts Manjushri as a young man like this. You always see him as either an older man, a wise man, or an older, very fierce man, you know, wielding this blade of wisdom. Here, he's quite young. So it's an interesting tanka, and I think quite beautiful, and that's what the imagery is of his holding the knife, is that when you have these insights, it slashes through ignorance and opens reality up so that you can see it clearly. So I'm going to give a series of talks about this idea of not self or non-self or no self, or which all of which, you know, I think these English attempts to describe it are misleading. But I want to lay a context and set several themes to fit those talks into, because in order to really have an understanding of this, you have to be willing to step back from where you are right now, or where your mind is, where the conventional mind is that's kind of holding on and wants things to be very clear and tangible and understandable. You've got to step back into a much broader open space where there may be ambiguity, and that ambiguity gets filled in by direct experience. That's the key. Because wisdom is about an experience, and that's the reason the title is important. It's wisdom arising from the experience of non-self or not-self. And that's not accidental. And the way that Bhikkhu Bodhi's book in this area is laid out is really quite beautiful. You know, it starts with an explanation of wisdom. It talks about the process of becoming, which is synonymous with the process of suffering. It goes into the five aggregates, which we talked about for several weeks, and how to practice with those, and moves then into non-self. All of those things are basically the same thing. They're the same thing, looking at it from a different angle. And so we get confused because we think, well, these are all different things. And if you actually think of them as actually the same thing, but looking at it from a different trajectory or a different angle, I think it can be very helpful. And, you know, during the course of these several talks, I'll try to explain that. So the direct cause or the proximate cause of wisdom related to this topic are three core elements that the Buddha said that you can live a better life, you can be happier, you can have more pleasure, you can have greater ease. But if you do not have direct experiences of these three core things, you cannot liberate the mind. And we all know what they are. Okay? They're dukkha, anicca, anatta. They're suffering, the causes of suffering. Okay? There is the process or constantly changing impermanent nature of all phenomena. No exceptions to that rule, other than the liberated mind. And this last element of non-self or not self. So the Buddha said those three things are, you know, like, I've always been interested in architecture. And structurally, what makes something work? And I've been interested in the later work of I.M. Pei, who created, you know, that glass pyramid at the Louvre in Paris, you know, which was so controversial, and, you know, they wanted to hang him, and they wanted to hang the president for commissioning it and everything, and everybody loves it, you know. But if you look at that thing, it's extraordinary because it's all based on principles of tension. And he did a lot of that work. He did some very interesting temple work in Japan doing this. So I see that very akin to practice because the, like the Transamerica building, I was fascinated from the minute they started to build that, and they decided to build this, you know, this pyramid kind of thing in the middle of San Francisco, not too long after the earthquake. And so the bottom of that thing is extraordinary. It has these basically unsophisticated explanation. It has these unbelievable shock absorbers that allow that building to move. And in the event, theoretically, of a big earthquake, supposedly that thing will survive because of these shock absorbers, you know. And so that's what I envision anicca and anatta and dukkha, or at least the direct experience of them, as being to this practice. And that's my understanding of what the Buddha said, is that they are foundational. Yeah, they're not optional. And so the understanding these at some level, and more importantly, experiencing them, beginning to explore the experience from different angles so you start to get a sense of it, is critical to a long-term maturing practice. And to clarify at the outset, I'm sure everybody's heard this, but I'm going to try to say it in a slightly different way. The notion of not-self or non-self or whatever you want to call it is not a denial of personality or identification or identity. What it actually is a recognition that those things are not only a process that's constantly changing, but a specific process of becoming and selfing that the Buddha described. And that process of becoming and selfing is synonymous with suffering. Okay, I'm going to repeat that part. Sounds really simple, but it's huge. Okay? Okay. That there is a process which, and this is the reason, in my opinion, why the way this book is structured is so beautiful, is that the Bhikkhu Bodhi collected all of these suttas that were not given in a sequential order or given in a topical order. And he's put them into that. And so he describes, has this whole process of becoming and selfing, which is another term for it, is dependent origination. And then he moves into, well, how do you unwind? How do you unpack that so you actually see that it's a process, but it's not a thing? But identity is not a thing. And it's not permanent, that it's actually changing all the time in response to conditions. You know, like you wake up and you wake up in the morning, and that particular morning, for whatever reason, you're the person who's getting up depressed. You're the depressed person. And then by 10 o'clock, something happens, and now you're the person who's very satisfied with something. And then by early afternoon, you're something else, and it just keeps going, you know. And why we think it is so solid is because over a period of years, we've identified with particular traits and mental formations. So the process at its core of Buddhist practice is unlearning through direct experience a whole series of things that our mind wants to tell us are not to be unlearned. And even if you wanted to, you couldn't unlearn because they're solid and they're a certain thing. Okay, and then when you start to do this work, lo and behold, you start to have these experiences that the Manjushri, some of them are small and some of them, but they cut through that assumption, that belief, that illusion, and it's like, boy, you know, maybe there is something on the other side of the veil that is much bigger than I've ever thought about or that my mind even thought was possible. So that's where this practice takes us. So I'd like to go into a couple of things, and this goes to the notion of what practice is about in the end. And if you think back to those two talks that I gave, if you were here, and if you weren't here, actually I would encourage you to listen to them about the five aggregates, is that those talks talk about a fundamental process of practice of going all the way back to the basics. You know, we want to deal with, you know, a story about our life, a whole series of dramas, external events. And what the Buddha wanted us to do was go to the underlying process of how experience arises. And so that's what those talks are about. And how he encouraged us to do those. And if you pick up even a small little bit of those practices, they're transformational. It's amazing how it will start to shift how you understand all of these teachings. Okay. So I spoke with a lawyer in Honolulu today. And this is a woman lawyer, a Korean woman. I'd never talked to her before. I left my cell phone because I wanted to make sure that we connected. And so I'm doing something in the kitchen. The phone rings, and you know, like I've got some plates and hello, and she's on the line, and she's got a cold, and she's got this very kind of deep voice. And in 15 minutes, we had a discussion that would have taken any other lawyer that I've ever met probably an hour to have that discussion. I mean, this person was extraordinary in terms of how she knew what was important, how to cut through everything that was not important, the key factual considerations that were going to govern her perspective in rendering an opinion, and wasn't worried about presentation or whether I liked her, you know, or whether she was coming off well. I mean, it's like nothing was candy-coated, and it was like, no bullshit during this discussion. I mean, that was the message. And it's amazing. I mean, I hung up that, and I mean, I had so much respect for that person. And I thought, now that's a great lawyer, and that's a great mind, because she's trained herself to go to these underlying things, you know, to not be distracted, okay? And that's, Buddha was constantly warning us about being distracted by things, okay? So that leads me to the quotation that was this one from the Dalai Lama and the Thubten Chodron, where they're talking about the difference between positive and negative, or wholesome and unwholesome emotions from a conventional everyday perspective and from a Buddhist perspective. And this was part of the e-news, and I hope people took the opportunity to read it. And if you didn't, I encourage you to study it, because it just is a complete shift in terms of the angle that you're coming in to understand things. You know, on a conventional level, we're very concerned about how we feel in the moment, and then rating that feeling and that emotion as good or bad, primarily around self-interest and pleasure and pain. You know, it's just the way it is. And what the Dalai Lama and Chodron are basically saying is that that's not the test at all. The test is, where does the emotion that you are experiencing right now take you? So, does that point your mind towards satisfaction and peace? Or does it point your mind towards more confusion and agitation? And I mean, we could put many things on both sides of that equation. But, and then they say, so the test is a long-term test, not a short-term test. So why would they say that? And the reason they would say that is what I was saying, is the Buddha was constantly warning us, is that we're constantly doing things to distract ourselves, to be in denial, to be in avoidance, to be compensating. And frequently the way we do that is by doing something that makes us feel good, or that we think makes us feel good. And that's what a lot of addiction is about. And I'm getting this hit, and so next time I have to do twice as much to get that hit. But, you know, somehow our mind and our body keeps convincing us that if I do it, you know, and just complete denial, you know. So this is really critical, because this is, you know, back to the bottom of the Transamerica building, this is one of the core ideas of Buddhist practice. You know, that what is a value, what is wholesome and unwholesome, is not what I'm feeling is pleasant or unpleasant right now. All that has to do with is personal preference and attachment. What it has to do with is where we're pointing the mind, because everything is a training. In every single moment, we're making a decision, even when we're not making a decision, which is the dangerous part. You know, we're unconscious most of the time, and so we're making decisions based on habit and out of rote, and primarily reinforcing states of mind that are taking us away from lasting and deep satisfaction. So they are reinforcing the notion that what we're trying to do is bring this up to the surface and actually begin watching for it. Guy Armstrong, that I had mentioned a few minutes ago, on the other side of this page, has a really, what I think is a fascinating quotation, and once again, another foundation in terms of understanding what it is that we're doing. So, he says, past karma may have shaped our present, but it is our will expressed now that sets our future course through Dharma practice, we are shaping our character, which shapes our life. We can choose how we want to shape our life. So, I mean, that's the starting place. We can choose to adopt this longer-term perspective of what is of value and wholesome and unwholesome and emotions that the Dalai Lama and children are talking about, or we can just ignore that or act like we didn't hear it and stay stuck in running from one temporary form of pleasure to another, or constantly engaging in denial, avoidance, and distraction through engaging in experiences which we tell ourselves are pleasant. But here's the key part. If we aspire to ordinary worldly happiness, the way to that is through wholesome acts, especially of generosity, virtue, and loving kindness, which are the three bases of meritorious action. If we aspire to liberation, however, which the Buddha called the highest form of happiness, these three bases are important, but they're not sufficient. Those three aren't going to liberate your mind. Generosity, virtue, and loving kindness can still be done from a place of self. So this whole process of becoming and selfing, we can just use these terribly wholesome things just to prop up our sense of an independent self. Okay? So wholesome acts can be used to support the construction of a more polished, beautiful self-image. Such acts can lead to happiness, but until we have seen through self, we are still creating new karma and continuing the rounds of becoming. Okay. So, I find this very provocative. Because, I mean, it's very clear that the Buddha said there's two kinds of practice. You know, there's practice at kind of the ordinary, everyday level, where we do things to make ourselves feel better about ourselves, to feel more comfortable, to live with more ease, you know, all of which is very positive. And then there is another form of practice, and that is actually about liberating our mind from suffering. So you could see those as two different forms of practice, which in a way they are, or you could see them as two forms of practice that complement each other. And if you want to liberate the mind, you have to do both of them and learn how to integrate them. Or you could understand them as the maturing of the practice. Because these not-self kinds of practices are, they're if you haven't grasped this and willing to struggle with the ambiguity and confusion and uncertainty about the shift in perspective, which is so big, they're difficult practices. Okay. So because we're this is a little abbreviated tonight, I'm gonna. So what are the implications of these two big perspective changes for our practice? And sometimes I think it's helpful to have an imagery. So I have another quote here from a book that I'm reading right now. It's because I love Varanasi, Banaras, Kashi, the city in India. It's considered to be the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. And it's, for those of you who don't know about it, when you see pictures of India where people are doing puja in the water and there's the burning ghats, most of the time it's a Varanasi, and it's an extraordinary place. And so in addition to being important for many reasons from a Buddhist perspective, it's the center, at least in India, of the Muslim world. And there's more Muslim temples in Varanasi, which is a Hindu city, than any other place in India. You can take all of the Muslim temples in all of India, and there's more in Varanasi than the rest of India. And then it is the epicenter of Hindu practice. And it's believed that if you can just get there and die in Varanasi, you will be guaranteed a favorable rebirth. I mean, and people believe this. I mean, there's whole kind of broken down, dilapidated little apartment buildings, all of which are filled with people waiting to die. So they come there and get one of those rooms, and they wait to die because they know that if they can get there, they can get in the Ganges, you know, Mother Ganges, that they will, in fact, be saved. So it's also this very wild place energetically. You know, those of us who have been there a couple of times, the energy in Varanasi is just insane. It's like nothing I've ever experienced any place. So this is a little description of one of the places in Varanasi where there are a lot of silk salesmen and herb salesmen, and it's kind of a marketplace. And this is a great book by Piers Moore Eddy. So this guy is, he hasn't written much, but his writing is beautiful and it's lyrical. And he lived, this is a year in Varanasi that he lived there, and then all these different angles about the city. It's really worth reading. He's describing the scene. So he says, the narrow gullis, and you know, this is this old city, and some of the, quote, streets, you can do that and touch the buildings on both sides. Okay, so then you're walking down that, and, you know, you'll come around a corner, and there'll be a cow. And, you know, like, okay, like, how am I going to maneuver this, right? So he said, the narrow gullis hum with commerce. All business is a form of theater here. Food is flipped with comical panache. Chai is poured from an absurd height into glasses for it to cool. Whenever possible, basic procedures are complicated by elaborate movements of the hands, exaggerated shaking of the head, or a downturned mouth. Masti, love of life, trills into every second of time so that food is savored more loudly, complaints are more voracious, spiritual practice is more intense. So it's a wonderful description, you know. And when I read this, I said to myself, well, that's exactly what my mind does. You know, rather than just stay with a base experience, what it does is it always has to add something onto the experience. You know, it has to usually, I mean, the Buddha's description is that the mind reaches out to begin to grasp onto something and assigns meaning to it and then elaborates on the meaning, makes several layers of that so it becomes more complex, and then adds an emotion or two onto the top of that. And so it's this process called papancha, or conceptual proliferation, which is then accompanied by a proliferation of emotion. So what the Buddha is trying to do is have us get down below all of the complication and all of the noise, to turn the volume down, to simplify things, and get back down to the fundamental process. So in my last talk, when we were talking about the five aggregates, you know, we were talking about, well, just go outside, you know, go to a mall and just sit there and just watch and see if it's true that when something goes by and touches your eye, that something actually happens. You know, that the consciousness of whatever is there arises, that there is a feeling tone to it, and that the mind elaborates on that. And if you do that, you'll find out that it does happen. So with each one of the sense doors, consciousness from a Buddhist perspective is not unitary. There's consciousness associated with each sense door, and consciousness arises through the contact of a sense object and a sense door. So if we could actually, particularly in sitting meditation, actually get back to starting to see that, then we begin to understand the very nature of our consciousness in a completely different way. not conceptually, because we're seeing this very simple experience over and over and over again, and we're beginning to see that, in fact, it's true, and that it has some big-time consequences, because we don't think that that's what's happening. We think that consciousness is something else, you know, and we think that it's being driven by a higher level of mind. And you begin to see that this, the whole theme of experience starts being driven at a level that is normally non-recognized or non-conscious. Okay? So here, that's what the Buddha wants us to do, the same thing. Eddie talks about, Piers Moore, Eddie talks about going from this environment, you know, this kind of crazy market environment where, you know, they're taking chai and pouring it like this and, you know, all of these things, the thing with your head, and, you know, it's just overwhelming, all the stimulation, to going out into the countryside to visit one of the Muslim towns that does very simple weaving. And this is part of his visiting the very sophisticated part of silk weaving that Varanasi is known for. So out here, it's basically cotton. And he talks about arriving there, getting out of the car, and suddenly being able to hear everything. You know, like he can actually hear the birds. And where in the town, there were so many smells and they were so strong that they were overwhelming, he couldn't distinguish them. And now getting out of the car, he can actually distinguish the smells of flowers and trees and what have you. Okay? And so that is actually what happens with these basic practices, is that all of the activity in the mind, all the agitation, starts to settle down, and then you can actually start to see this underlying substructure, infrastructure, whatever you want to call it, but it's the base nature of experience. You can see that and start distinguishing its elements and how they relate to each other. It's really a very, very exciting thing. So what could we do, and to show you how simple it is, this is the last part of the handout. How could we take some of these themes and ideas and turn it into a practice? Okay. And this process of becoming, of selfing, has a very distinct thing about it. And over the years, we've talked about this in a number of different ways. But the distinct thing about it is that as the mind reaches out and starts to grab onto something, clinging or attachment, right? You know, the mind starts to constrict around something and hold on to it. And then if that continues, it's a continuum, it moves into identification. And then we go completely unconscious. At the attachment part, we can frequently see the mind reaching out. We can see the energetic level, you know, leaning out. And by the time we hit identification, most of the time, we can't see that, because now everything is moving from exclusively, is being generated out of place of self-interest and self-centeredness. Okay? So as that process happens, this very distinct thing happens that's associated with becoming and selfing. And what it is a physical feeling in the body and mind of separation. Okay, so I'm sure all of us have had the experience of, you know, you're at lunch, having just a great discussion with somebody, having a cup of coffee, you know, just simpatico, you know, wow, this is fantastic. And somebody says something that makes the other person defensive, or the other person objects to the tone of voice or what's said, and immediately there is this pulling back away from this engagement, and a sense of separation starting to occur. And you can feel that very distinctly in your body if you train yourself and if you watch for it, and you can feel it in your mind. So what I'm going to suggest is a practice around this, and then we're going to back into the notion of not self from feeling what becoming or selfing feels like. And if you can begin to feel that process, we can start to unwind and examine, well, what does it feel like when that's not present? Which, if we do it right, is an experience of the reverse. Rather than becoming, it's an experience of not being, or not being independent, okay? So, experientially, and this you could do this in daily life, but to make these practices really work, you just have to be doing it in your sitting practice because of the subtlety of a lot of this. And then that becoming the ground for your being able to use it in daily life. So what you might do is the same thing I suggested with the five aggregates. If you're sitting for 45 minutes, you get the mind settled so there's a level of concentration, and then for 15 minutes you do the practice I'm about to suggest, and then end up with what you normally do in your practice or with metta or some other practice. But that in the center, after the mind has calmed down, you do this. And so there would be four potential parts to it. So the first one would be, can you actually feel a sense of separation? So that's psychologically, physically, emotionally. You might be able to feel one, you might be able to feel all. It might be quite intense, it may be so subtle that you almost don't feel it. But if you have any serious thoughts at all that arise, or any serious emotions that arise in a sitting, it's inescapable that this is occurring. So it's just beginning to open up to there being a larger set of experiences that are actually just waiting there for you, and focusing your mind to be open to that possibility and looking for them. You're not trying to make it happen, you're not trying to create it, but you are trying to hold an open space for the possibility that is present. And then, it's kind of like an exploration. The Buddha made the analogy that he was in a jungle, this very, very dense jungle, and then came upon a clearing, and in the clearing was this temple, which is the Dharma. But before he got to the clearing, he was just lost in this dense jungle. The notion that, like, maybe 10 feet from where I am, there was a clearing with a temple, like kind of a preposterous thought. So here is just opening to the possibility that this may be there, and to watch for it. So first of all, can you feel a sense of separation? And then if you could feel that, what does it feel like? Where do you feel it in your body? How does it manifest itself? There's a fundamental practice that we're all familiar with, right? Where is it? How big is it? Does it have an energetic quality to it? And then if you can identify this, what happens when it is present? So does something happen with your thoughts? Or if it's in daily life, does something happen with your speech or your behavior? Because when we tend to separate, this tends to be a different, we're processing what's in front of us, the experience in front of us, differently than when we don't feel a sense of separation. One feels tighter or more closed or closed off, and the other feels less restrictive, more open or wide open. It's all a spectrum. It's not the little either-ors. It's this whole spectrum. So what actually happens, and then how does that affect our thoughts, our emotions, our speech and our behavior? So then you begin to see the relationship between the sense of separation and everything else that we, how we define ourselves. Okay, so we've got time for one or two questions, if there are any. Yes?
One thing that's a little confusing about your instruction is that it sort of assumes you know what it feels like when you don't feel separated, right? So I'm not trying to make a semantic thing, but I think it's one thing to move from a sense of not feeling separated or connected, moving to that. But if you don't recognize what the first thing feels like, how do you suggest people recognize this more open, spacious, connected feeling before the separation starts?
You know, I this is an interesting question, and not being facetious with this answer. If we started with the idea of a non-separation, my guess is that somebody would say, well, what about the people who don't know what that feels like? You know, so it's like a conundrum. You've got to start someplace. And my sense is that if everybody thinks about it, that almost everybody in this room can think of a situation where they have felt separated from somebody else in an argument, or even if there isn't an argument, that somebody said something and suddenly they're just, man, I mean, you're just closed down, right? And I definitely feel separated from this person that I normally don't feel that way, you know? So my guess is that that's true, and that if people think about that and then sit this way and just stay open and just watch, that they'll begin to see that there's a qualitative change in their experience, and that it has something to do with this opening and closing, okay? And maybe separation is, back to, well, what's the right language, okay? You know, it could be, I feel open or I feel closed. That's a feature of separation or non-separation, you know? So whatever the correct description of these two options are that are really a continuum is what I'm trying to talk about.
Maybe you're suggesting you notice when a change happens and then what's going on when that change happens?
Yeah, that could be true. You know, it might not be identifying this particular phenomenon. You know, I mean, like a change could be that I feel a greater intensity of anger or joy, where I'm going completely by the sense of closeness or separateness because I'm so caught in the joy or the anger, right? So somehow you've got to call up conceptually that there's another dimension other than normally the selfing or the becoming dimension of just being identified with the emotion or the intensity of the emotion. So I'd say, you know, give it a try, and let's see if this is helpful or not. You know, it's an experiment, right? But, I mean, this actually is a direct recommendation of the Buddha in terms of practice to look for these. So, okay, anything else? All right, so I would encourage you to try this. It may initially feel a little foreign. And it may take a couple of weeks, you know, of working with this. But if you can even have a beginning experience, my guess is that you'll recognize that it's something really worth following. Okay. So, okay, and thank you all very much for coming here and your intentions, and certainly my deepest hope and wish in the world is that our collective effort will spread out into this community and through our own action, and then in some intangible way that the Buddha talks about will affect others in a wholesome and positive way and lead to the reduction of suffering in the world. So thank you very much.